We'd like to thank our sponsor, Purina Pro Plan, fuel for life. More sporting dog champions feed Pro Plan than any other brand of dog food.
Welcome back to another episode of Save It for the Blind. So this week we have four special guests. These are refuge managers throughout the state of California. So we go all the way from SoCal, we go to Yolo, go to the Upper Butte Basin, and Gray Lodge. So check out what these refuge managers have to say. So our next guest for the upcoming Waterfowl Outlook is Tim Hermanson. He is the manager over at Gray Lodge. Also was up at the Upper Butte Basin for a long time. So Tim, thanks for joining us. If you want to give a little bio about yourself, since we haven't had you on here before, of kind of your career with the department and what you're doing now, would be appreciated.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for having me on today, Jeff. I've been at Gray Lodge Wildlife Area. It'll be 5 years at the end of this month as the manager here. I started my career with the department at Upper Butte Basin in 2013 as the manager over there. So 7.5 years or so at those areas. And then when the opportunity came up to transfer here, I couldn't help myself. So been with the department, like I said, since 2013. Before that, I was doing private lands management with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, in Colusa County, and then also out in Nebraska, along with Pheasants Forever out there. So it's been a good career.
Nice. I mean, do you prefer one over the other, Upper Butte Basin versus Gray Lodge?
I mean, they both have great, unique characteristics. It's hard to say I prefer one over the other. It's interesting here at Gray Lodge. It's one contiguous block of habitat in the almost 9,300 acres we have. We're at Upper Butte Basin. There's the three separate units, which they all have different and unique things about them. I'm happy to be here at Gray Lodge. It's, you know, it's got the history. It's got the unique habitats we have here, the variety of public use between hunting and non-hunting, and it's a cool place to work. Great place to be.
Yeah, no, it's such a cool refuge. And if no one's ever been on the auto tour there, pretty spectacular. That one and the one at Sac Refuge are pretty phenomenal. But in terms of, like, you know, you're right in the heart of the Butte Sink, and that's open to the public. In terms of, you know, habitat and stuff for this year, I mean, what are you guys seeing on the ground compared to the last couple of years with, you know, the abundance of water this year and last?
So a couple things. For this year, we are doing a big habitat enhancement project in coordination or partnership with Ducks Unlimited and the Wildlife Conservation Board. So a big chunk of our closed zone, almost half of it this year was needing, well, the whole closed zone, but we're doing work in about half of it. So that was all needing to remain dry for the season so they could get in and do the work. That really impacted our ability to do irrigations and move water. But despite that, we still irrigated over 2,000 acres of our habitats. Had a great response from the moist soil plants, like the water grass, the smart weed, on those areas that we were able to irrigate. And things are looking pretty good, actually. A little bit behind, I must say, on some of our flooding and mowing than from where I'd want to be, but I think we're going to be pretty good going into the upcoming hunt season in a few weeks. And habitat conditions overall, I say, look really, really good compared to previous years, drought years, that sort of thing. So, yeah, we're seeing quite a few birds on the area already, and I think they're just going to keep coming in as we get more areas flooded.
Yeah, no, that's great. In terms of the project in the close zone, what specifically were you guys doing out there?
A lot of regrading of the fields to improve our ability for irrigating those fields and holding water, as well as improving irrigation conveyance systems, improving canals. Some of those fields hadn't been touched or manipulated in decades, and there were areas that would hold water that we didn't want to have hold water, or we couldn't get water to very easily. We also took it as an opportunity to improve some public safety on the auto tour loop. If anybody had been on it in the past, you might remember a few areas where the road had near vertical side slopes into ditches and canals. So we moved the road over, put some nice gentle side slopes on them, added some more turnouts for wildlife viewing opportunities, and just made it hopefully a better, safer place for the public, and improve things for wetland managers or us here on the wildlife area to manage the water and get some better habitat or improved habitat for the birds on those fields.
Well, that's awesome. And in terms of, you know, hunting season is right around the corner. Usually the week of the opener, you know, I drive by there to work and people start, you know, lining up in the sweat line, or are those people that have actually drawn the hunt? I've sad to say, I've never hunted Gray Lodge. What's the deal and how does the process work when you are trying to get on, either as someone that has a ticket and then someone that doesn't?
Right. So, you know, similar to other type A wildlife areas, we have the reservations that you apply for through the online ALDS program. And that gets you a spot in line that pretty much the way we set our quotas is if you have a reservation, you're guaranteed a spot on the wildlife area. It might not be the best spot, but you have a spot to enter. The guys that you see in our check station line leading up to a hunt day, we call those our sweat line, or our first come, first serve people.
Okay.
They camp out there all week leading up to opening day. Next Saturday on the 11th, we'll start allowing the trailers to come in to our check station parking lot. And then starting that day, they can line up. And the only rule is they have to stay in the parking lot the whole week. If they leave to go to town or head back home or something like that, and they get caught, they get kicked out of line. So once you're in line, you gotta stay there until we issue our numbers on the day before the hunt day. So Friday this year, what is it? Friday the 17th. We'll issue out the tickets for the sweat line people. And then after they get the number, they can head to town, take a shower, do whatever they want, and then show back up the next day. Then on opening morning, we'll process out the reservation holders, the folks that got their lucky ticket online. Go through as many of those as show up, and then we'll fill out the rest of our hunt quota for the day with the sweat line holders.
And that works the same during the regular season. The sweat line, you just line your cars up and you guys just go car to car, basically saying, here's your number for the sweat line.
Exactly. Yeah. It's less noticeable on the rest of the season. They'll just usually line up the day of the hunt, mm-hmm. or the day before the hunt, and get their numbers that night. They won't camp out all week, but there's, you know, for opening day, there's so much excitement with everybody that they'll stick it out. There's guys that will camp all week in whatever the weather conditions are and feeding mosquitoes. Yeah. And it's kind of crazy, but they do it and they love it.
Yeah. I mean, literally it's like clockwork every year. Like early Monday, they're people already in their cars lined up in the back of their trucks or whatever. And then, as you're right, you're seeing the same people all week. I never knew what the rules were. I didn't know if those were people like, you know, that had a ticket and, you know, it's first come, first serve or whatever. So they're there and they get to go on the refuge first, or how that worked. So, that makes sense now. In terms of like the trailers that you guys have out there, is that all first come, first serve, or is that a draw?
Yep, it's first come, first serve. We don't issue like a specific spot in the parking lot for folks to park their trailer. That Saturday morning, the 11th, we'll have employees there to make sure it's done in an orderly way. But we'll register the trailers in our registration system that we have. They can park there. The only rule is they have to, you know, register with us and have a hunting license to park their trailer there for the season and then get it out of there within 2 weeks of the season ending in February.
Yeah, okay. So, are there any new or significant changes to the hunt program this year?
Probably the most significant change this year is with that WCB Ducks Unlimited project. We rehabbed field 58, which is over on the east side. Some hunters might know it as the bowling alley or something like that. We rehabbed that, and then we're adding two new mobility impaired blinds to that field. So we're converting it from the free roam fields to spots for our mobility impaired hunters. We'll be getting those X Fowler floating blinds that we've seen at other refuges.
Yeah, those are great.
We'll be getting two of those in there and then having that field set for our MI hunters. And since I took over, I've been hearing a lot from the hunting community about a desire for MI blinds on the east side. And when we had this opportunity, I thought we'd take it and provide that extra access for you know, a segment of our hunting community.
And those spots, you know, for the MI hunters, it's also just first come, first serve. You guys don't have any like assigned blinds, correct?
We do have, well, so we have five existing MI blinds and then we're adding two more. So we'll have seven. They are first come, first serve to get them mm-hmm. at the check station. But once you have that ticket or a chip for that specific blind, it's yours for the day until you're done hunting. You won't have someone else try to come in and take your spot. So,
but, right.
You know, we only have a limited number of them, and sometimes we have more hunters than space. So hopefully with adding these two, we can accommodate more people coming out here.
But everything else on the refuge outside of those is what we'd call free roam, right? Just everything is right. Parking lots. Yeah.
Yep. Different parking lots and then hike out and hopefully find a spot that's well spaced out from other hunters. You know, if you're new to the area, it can be intimidating, but just try to find a spot in a field that looks good. Try to not be setting up right on top of other people. And, you know, if you're one of those hunters that comes here a long time or has been coming here for a long time, remember, don't set up next to other people. Don't sneak in on them and set up right on the other side of a tule patch. Keep your space from each other, and just it'll make it a happier and more enjoyable environment for everybody. So just wanted to throw that in since we're on the topic of free roam hunting out here. But
yeah, absolutely. And kind of what I've found is, you know, for those newer hunters that might be encroaching, you know, a lot of them just don't know, you know, the etiquette behind it. They might be new hunters, et cetera, or never hunted an area. And, you know, they don't know what the proper etiquette for the spacing may be. Right. But obviously you don't want to go close to someone where it becomes a safety issue, you know, with the firearms and the shot. So, that part of it, but yeah, I would stress to folks, you know, calmly talk to another hunting party if they are, you know, set up too close to you. It goes a long ways.
Yep, exactly. That's a great point. Is if you do encounter someone and they're setting up too close, be calm about it. And by and large, people are going to be reasonable back to you if you're reasonable towards them. So, yeah, the important thing is safety and having a good time.
Gray Lodge is probably the last refuge that doesn't have, you know, really assigned ponds or blinds per se. Is that a want from hunters that want that, to not have the crowding? And I know there's pros and cons to doing it all different ways, right? I mean, it's hard to please everyone, but are you hearing that from a lot of folks during like your hunter meetings?
We do hear a lot. You know, there's the diehard hunters that come here every day that like it the way it is, and they're vocal from their side. But we also have a pretty substantial number of people who said they would come here more if we had more assigned hunting spots. And I think there was that survey the department did that showed that people would appreciate more assigned hunting locations. So we are exploring the ideas for future years of how to do more assigned hunting out here. We're hoping to install our rice blinds before the 2026 season. We were wanting them for the 2025 season, the upcoming year, but with conditions on the ground, we weren't able to get them in time. And also constraints with giant garter snake dormant season and that sort of thing. So those will be our first dipping the toes into the water, so to speak, of assigned hunt spots outside of our mobility impaired blinds. And then I'm thinking of other ways to expand those assigned hunting spots across the wildlife area.
On those rice blinds or those rice fields, so those are open currently where you can go just free roam the rice fields right there off Pennington?
Correct. Okay. We'll keep them closed temporarily until the rice farmer is done with their harvest and prep. But usually by mid-November, they're open. And it's just a first come, first serve, free roam type of hunting out there if anybody wants to go. But once we get those four blinds put in, we'll be making that assigned hunting and have a special parking lot right there off of Pennington Road for those four blinds, for making it a bit easier to get to compared to the mile and a half hike you have right now to get out there.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Yeah, because I haven't seen, you know, many people hunting that during the shoot days. But, man, I've seen it a few times where there is a lot of ducks and geese using that area just right there off the road. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. And I remember back when I was going to college, home for winter, my brother and I hiked all the way from parking lot 5 out to those rice fields. And nobody else was around us, and we just had an incredible hunt that day. Pintail, widgeon, a few geese, and I just hope, you know, we can recreate opportunities like that for people with those blinds and keep people away from sitting on top of you. And we'll see what happens, but I think it'll be a good opportunity and well-liked by the hunting public when we get those blinds in the ground.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. And in terms of, you know, Pintail and Gray Lodge, do you guys expect your harvest to go up with the 3 pintail bag limit? And what typically is your guys's, you know, top couple birds each season?
Typically our top birds have been shoveler, widgeon. I think with the 3 pintail limit, unless they all just decide to stop going into the hunt zone, they might become our top bird. I'd say on any given day, most people the last several years have come in with the pintail, or a lot of people do. So I think with that new 3 bird limit for pintail, I think we'll see a significant increase in the harvest out here, and it might push them towards the top of our bird list.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. And you know, being in the Butte Sink, and then you've obviously managed you know, Little Dry Creek. Why in your opinion is it where it's like, you know, Little Dry Creek is historically known for shooting mallards, where, you know, Gray Lodge, it does have those areas, but it might not be as known for a mallard hunting spot in today's age. What's your reasoning on that? Is it kind of just different types of habitats or closed zones in the area or other clubs, or?
I'm not sure. I think some of it is the habitat types. Gray Lodge, you know, it's a lot more open. There's a lot more alkali habitat here, which might lend itself more towards the pintail, the teal, where Dry Creek has more of the riparian corridors and thicker areas that mallards might tend towards. But I don't know. I look at some of the fields and I think, why aren't there thousands of mallards sitting on it? Where over at Dry Creek, similar looking habitat, and there'd be mallards all over it, but I don't know. We'll have to ask, you know, someone like Brian Huber or someone. But I will say this summer, on the semi-permanent, the brood water that we had on the wildlife area, I saw a lot more mallards on Gray Lodge than I have in the past several years, both hens with broods and then later in the summer, the molting adults. So there's a lot of them out here right now. And I think at least the first opening week or two, we might see a pretty good harvest of mallards on Gray Lodge. So hopefully that holds true.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, we're getting, those same types of firsthand accounts and reports from lots of refuge managers down in, you know, up here, obviously, but our properties down in Sisu were the same, you know, lots of birds up in Klamath. So, yeah, it'll be interesting year. You know, we have this nice little weather pattern with us right now, you know, some rain and low 70s, you know, kind of leading up to opening weekend. And it's not going to be one of those 90-degree openers. So that's definitely a plus. But I think, you know, a lot of people are excited for this season and definitely for that, you know, 3 pintail bag to see how that changes things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see that. And I will say, I guess, before we close out, we are implementing a few changes at the check stations. Everyone's going to be going to that wildlife area processing online check-in, check-out system. And that also includes our sweat line development and the lottery line list development at other areas. So there are going to be a few changes that might slow things down, requiring photo ID, going in order as we call reservations, that sort of thing. So as you come out, things are going to be a little bit different and it might be a little bit slower than you're used to, but just be patient and we'll still get you on the field in plenty of time to get set up.
So will you guys have its own window for that, or is it just normal process, you know, scanning it?
Normal process of scanning it. As much as the system will allow us to do, we might have to reconfigure how we do our sweat line development, or I think the biggest slowdown is going to be the calling reservations in order and figuring out how to make that still happen in an orderly fashion for the morning hunters. So we're going to give it a try, see how it goes and adjust from there. And I think there was a big interest from the public to do it that way. And we should do as much as we can for the public. We are a public agency. So we're trying to align with a few things there and make that happen.
Now, is that going to be a requirement in the future, or is this something that everyone's going to try out right now to see how it works?
It's going to be a requirement for a lot of check stations where they only process people through one window at a time. It's not a big deal for them. Mm-hmm. For us, where we ran 3 windows and called up batches of hunters, like batches of 10, that'll be where our change is. And then if there's other spots that you didn't have to line up in order at all, like Grizzly Island, where you could just go and as long as you had a reservation, you were in line. So they're going to be, I think, delaying down at Grizzly Island that implementation, but we're going to try it here, and it's just going to be a little bit of a tweak and a little bit slower than we've done in the past. So we have a few ideas in mind of how to make it happen, and we're going to try it. And like I said, we'll adapt from there and try to fine tune it, make things work.
Yeah. And a couple other managers, you know, are eager to try it, but yeah, you know, obviously everyone's got to be a little patient this year just to work the kinks out.
I think in the end, it'll be a good thing.
I think the changes will be good, you know, kicking people out that have had, you know, multiple, you know, numbers and things like that to really get a fine tune of how many people are actually there to hunt.
Yeah, I agree.
Tim, do you have anything to leave us with?
I'd just say, hope to see everybody out here this year. I really think the habitat looks great on the wildlife area. Seeing quite a few ducks and geese already showing up. And I think that we're ready for another successful season at Grey Lodge and in the Sac Valley. So, I mean, it's coming way too quick, but I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, as always, if you have any questions, feel free to call our office. We'll be getting the tour loop opened in a couple weeks. We're just doing some fine tuning on that. So you'll be able to come out and see the new improvements on that project. And, yeah, when you make it out, just have a good time and be safe, everyone. I appreciate all you do for us here on the Wildlife Area and the support that you give us. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Tim. Thanks for jumping on today. And thanks for everything that you're doing out there. We appreciate it. The hunters do. So here's another good season.
Indeed.
So the balance of the state zone opens this weekend, October 18th. It's a weekend that we've all been waiting for. Just some gentle reminders. So you could shoot 7 ducks per day, 2 of which may be hen mallards, 3 pintail, new this year, 2 canvasbacks, 2 redheads, and 2 scop. Please note, scop don't open until November 4th through January 28th. Also, our goose bag limit is 30 per day, which may include 20 white geese and up to 10 dark geese. So dark geese are going to be your Canada geese, Aleutians, Specks, etc. If you happen to be hunting in the Sacramento Valley goose management zone, so we have white fronts that are going to be currently open all the way through December 21st. In that zone, you can only have 3 specks per day. October 18th will be our November hunt draw for all of our hunts in our hunt program. So this includes fall turkey hunts, all of our waterfowl hunts in November, and we have a couple deer hunts. So go to calwaterfowl.org and apply today. We also have some upcoming events. So October 16th, we have the Folsom Wild Game Feed. We have the Butte Sink Barbecue on October 17th. We're also going to be out at the Mendota parking lot also on October 17th and out in Lambertville on October 18th. So for more information regarding tickets, go to calwaterfowl.org. This is a reminder that we do have some first-come, first-serve hunts offered at our new Potrero property. So there's a couple blinds left to reserve. Go to calwaterfowl.org. Also, if you know anyone that wants to get into duck hunting, we have 2 duck camps. One of them is at the end of October, and the other one is in December. So it's a how to learn everything that you need to know about waterfowling. Food, lodging, etc. is included in the price, and we could provide gear, jackets, firearms, etc. Our next guest is Dave Van Baron. He is the wildlife manager in what we call the Upper Butte Basin. So that includes the famed Little Dry Creek, Howard Slough, and Llano Seco. So, Dave, appreciate you coming on. Yeah, what do you got for us? What's it looking like up there in the Upper Butte Basin?
This year's looking really good. We got full allocation of water this year, and we were able to do irrigations on all 3 units. So all 3 units have produced excellent food this year. We're a little behind on our mowing and getting field prep done, but we're trying to knock that out as soon as possible. And this rain just kind of pushed us a little bit further behind. But the pond should look really good, and we were able to do a lot of work this year.
In terms of, like, opening day, is your guys' quota usually, like, are you guys maxed out on opener, or do you guys have to wait to get max hunter capacity?
No, we usually, the problem with maxing out is we just don't have the water capacity, or the capacity to move as much water as needed to max out all the ponds. A lot of our ponds are, they're really old and, needing to be redone, and they flood serially. So you flood one pond and then flood the next one below it and so on and so forth. So we need to eventually get to the point where we can flood everything or have one main highlying ditch that'll take care of the water and move it as fast as we need it. Another drawback with Upper Butte Basin is Howard slew the upper end up in the 20s ponds. Those are the only ones that can really take just surface water only to flood. Little Dry Creek has some ability in some of the ponds coming off the 100 drain, but for the most part, every pond we flood, we have to low lift water to get into it. So it makes things, it slows down what we're able to flood at any given time.
Yeah, in terms of like the last couple of years with the droughts, you know, this year you're talking about you guys were able to irrigate what you wanted to, and it's looking good for the fall. How is that differentiated with the, you know, the habitat now compared to there, and the amount of huntable acres for a year like this year?
Well, I mean, the huntable acres would be the same year to year, because usually by mid season we've had enough rains that are flooding up the rest of the ponds. We can usually get the water out that we need for the opener, and the drought really affects mainly the irrigations that we're able to do. So we might not have as high quality habitat as we would otherwise. Little Dry Creek's in secondary water, and if it's a water short year and they cut the water off, then Little Dry Creek gets no water allocation other than what might come down the drain. Then we could capture some of the drain water. Llanos Secos in a different situation. It's not even in a water district at all. So in water short years, we're completely cut off from any water deliveries from Western Canal. We do have an allocation that we can take from M&T Ranch that comes through Llanos Seco, but they got these old wooden redwood siphons that have pretty much blown out and are collapsed. And so we haven't been able to utilize any of that water, at least since I've been there, and I've been there since 2021. The only delivery we ever got was around 3 CFS, and that water ended up being really, really expensive because they had to lift it to get it to us.
So like on a year like this year, a normal year, you guys are getting most of your water from Western Canal?
Little Dry Creek gets its water from Richvale Irrigation District. And Llano gets it from Western. We buy any surplus water they have, and we're able to flood. And I've turned in the water applications to get it. Once the rice farmer floods his water, or his rice fields are decomped, then we can move some of that water over to the habitats to maintain and bring up the habitats instead of using the deep well that we have out there.
Oh, okay. So like in terms of Llano, like on an opener, what's that look like on a hunter standpoint?
It's pretty much the same thing. Right now, we can't flood using Western Canal water until he harvests. Otherwise, there could be leakage going into the rice fields. So really, we got one deep well out in the middle that we can flood the ponds with. So we got to divide that deep well throughout the whole area trying to get water on. And I mean, we should actually look pretty good for Llano. I mean, by October we're hoping to get around 530 acres. Don't know if we'll make it, but we're doing our best to get there.
Okay. And how big is that closed zone right there off the road? It's always been impressive to me. I don't know why, but it seems like if you want to find a Eurasian widgeon, you just go out there on the Llano platform and get the binos out, and you'll find them late in the year.
Oh, that's all National Wildlife or Fish and Wildlife Service, the feds.
No, that's not you guys.
No, we're further down. We're further south.
Never knew that.
You know, yeah, there's like three entities called Llano Seco. There's Llano Seco Fish and Wildlife Service Unit, Llano Seco Ranch, which is a private ranch just right to the north of us, and then Llano Seco State Wildlife Area. So it's a lot of confusion, especially with PG&E, because they keep calling me to get access to Llano Seco Ranch, and I keep telling them, no, call these guys. So,
gotcha. So the viewing platform is not state-owned?
Nope. We have nothing to do with it.
Oh, gotcha. I just always assumed, I guess.
Yeah.
Like
a lot of people do. Yeah. A lot of people confuse them. When we close down for hunting, they can still go out to Llano Seco Fish and Wildlife Service and actually view birds and stuff. And during the season, we have bird watchers running our check station, trying to go out and look at our wildlife area, and we have to stop them and herd them back to the parking lot and tell them no, they can't go out there, and then they get mad at us and yell at us again.
Gotcha. That's great. Any big like habitat projects or wells or anything that you guys have been doing on any of the refuges to help with it with habitat?
Yeah, we out at Llano Seco, DU this year redid Hunt Field 20. So the last couple of years, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, those hunt fields have all been refurbished. So that whole west side of Llano Seco over the last 3 years is now complete. We were able to get a pretty good irrigation after it was done early enough in the year that we were able to irrigate it and grow some food out there. So all three of those ponds are just looking awesome this year. A lot of food was grown out in those ponds. DU also helped us with refurbishing our 103 lift pumps on Dry Creek. It's kind of a supplemental pump because last year the main siphon that feeds the west side of Little Dry Creek blew out, and it's a long process to get a siphon to go up underneath the channel that or the slough that exists there. So we're working on the environmental for that, and we tried thinking out of the box and ways we can kind of get around or get bridge over the top of it so we can at least get water to that side of the wildlife area easier. And we figured out it was easier just to refurbish the well, one of the wells up at, on the north side on one of the duck clubs and run it through that ditch and push water that way. And they just completed that this year.
Oh, good.
But I do want to say that CWA has been huge with our well maintenance this year. The state has a contract with CWA, and we wouldn't be able to do half the repairs as fast as we've been able to do them without that well contract with you guys. Both DU and CWA are huge to our operations. Both organizations help us out immensely and allow us to better manage the wildlife areas. It's great partnerships that I value a lot. I consider all the people that I work with both organizations friends, and I mean it's very valuable, and they're great people to work with.
Yeah, well, thanks for that plug. And with those wells and stuff, I mean, are you talking about lift pumps, deep wells? And for folks that don't, yeah, when we're talking, I mean, can you explain the cost differences in using some? I don't think some people really know what a lift pump is versus a well, and how substantially a well costs to run and the water that it puts out.
Well, one of the wells on Dry Creek that we'd been using until this 103 pump lift pump got repaired, I think it's around 600 feet deep, and it was costing us $16,000 a month to run this well. This is the first month we've run the lift pump, and I mean it's throwing great water from the surface water that we purchased from Richvale, and I haven't seen the bill yet, so I don't know what it was, but I know it's going to be cheaper than $16,000 a month.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And I mean, it's not like the well was in bad shape. I mean, we had it inspected. We had it had all the tests done on it, and it's functioning perfect. It's just pulling water from however deep that well is up to the surface is just expensive.
Yeah, no, it as we say lots of times, is, you know, probably the best bang for your buck is a type A refuge pass. You know, you get great hunting areas, habitat for, you know, a few hundred bucks, where, you know, if you're a member of a place like Little Dry Creek, or if you owned it yourself, it's a substantial amount of money to keep the habitat the way it is. And just paying for water, you know, water, mosquito abatement, then people to run tractors.
Power bills.
Yeah, you know, and I don't, you know, a lot of people don't realize that when they just buy their A pass or, you know, whatnot, and think that all their money is going to that. It's a lot more money than what we're putting in, you know, it's coming from other coffers as well to keep it going. But it's, you know, but a place like Little Dry Creek, I think for most folks that have hunted it, you know, it's extremely special. Usually known as the Mallard Refuge here in California. But how is that refuge?
Derek will get mad at me again if I don't say this, but last year we were the top. Little Dry Creek was the top mallard refuge in the state.
That's awesome.
We shot more mallards on our wildlife area than anywhere else in the state.
And how has that changed over the years? I mean, I think when the refuge first opened up, you know, it was primarily mallards. But during that time, our mallard numbers were much higher than they are now, too. And I don't think people realize that. But, you know, it comes and goes, right? I mean, in terms of some years are better than others.
One thing I want to throw a plug out for my crew and for all the crews on the wildlife areas. The dedication these crews have is impressive to me. They'll get out there middle of the night to cut trees out of the road from a storm just to try and get hunters out on the wildlife area. Rain, shine, flooding, they're willing to go out and do this work. And all of the wildlife areas, all the supervisors can be proud of the work that the crews put in every year to make these areas ready for hunting season.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Derek does a lot for us too, helping with our veteran hunt program. He's been amazing over the years being a guide, and he's just a wealth of knowledge and just a good person to be around. But is there any changes from on the refuges this year in terms of, you know, how you guys are processing people to, you know, anything else with sweat lines?
The biggest change this year for processing is all the areas are going to now be on the computer system, including for lottery. So we will definitely, in the past with Upper Butte, all three members of the party had to show up to register for the lottery. This year, because we were on the WA, the what we call the WILAP system, the Wildlife Processing System, we're allowing them just one person needing to come out for registering for the lottery this year. And if they have the Go IDs, then we'll be able to punch in the Go ID and see if they need any documents to be able to hunt, because that was one of the reasons why I kept having everybody come out, was we could stop it right there in the morning and make sure everybody has all their certificates and HIP and stamps or whatever else. And if they don't, then we say, okay, hey, you got to get this done before you come out in the morning. Well, with the wildlife processing system that we have now that's tied into ALDS, we can put in a Go ID and see if that person has all the certifications they need. So we can make sure they're aware of it, so there's not a hold up in the morning with someone trying to buy duck validation or do the HIP survey or whatever, because we can flag that the night before. And another big change for this year is when they come up to the window for the lottery for the morning processing, we're going to be, all the wildlife areas in the state are going to be requiring hunters to show their driver's license or some sort of photo ID card.
Okay.
What it seems like was happening, I think Grizzly was the worst that got caught, was hunters were coming out and they're using, because they can use their phone.
Mm-hmm.
What it sounds like some people were doing was giving their hunting information for the CDFW app and registering as somebody else.
Oh.
And the wardens caught some people, apparently, that were that had done that down at Grizzly. So that's why Grizzly last year was requiring the ID, and now we've kind of moved that statewide, where when you come in to get your harvest card in the morning, you need to show your ID to prove your who you are.
They need to also probably ask for people's license plates, maybe when they do their Go ID, so people aren't running back and forth to provide the license plate at the window as well. That one always gets me.
Yeah, we've kind of got away with that just because it's not required in the system anymore. When we were doing it all by hand, then yeah, we were using the license plate kind of as a backup, where if someone's doesn't come in, we can figure out who they are and try and contact either friends or family or whoever and try and figure out what's going on if they have medical issues and go try and find them in the field. But with the new system, we know who's come off and who's come off. Mm-hmm. So we could just look in the computer and say, okay, well, John Smith is hunting out of blind two at Little Dry Creek and they're still out in the field. So then we can send somebody out and try and figure out what's going on.
Well, that's good on a safety aspect of it. Do you guys run into, you know, like how many incidents are there a year like that where someone's a couple hours late from checking in the evening and, you know, might have a flat tire in the parking lot or.
Yeah, there's a couple, there's not many, but it does happen occasionally, where someone will have to go out and kind of look for them. Sometimes it's just, especially at Dry Creek where the hike is so far to get back to, some of the blinds. Some people just get tired after hunting all day and they just walking slow and eventually they'll make it in, but, we'll catch them in the parking lot. And they're, I mean, when I was, working at Grizzly back in the way back days, I was closing gates and these guys were sitting in the parking lot, cracking a beer, just enjoying the sunset and talking about the hunt. And, after watching them for about 5 minutes, I finally went up and said, look, I get on the other side of the gate. I can't go home until you're on the other side of the gate. So come on, let's move it. And, checked them out there in the field and they moved to the other side of the gate and continued to enjoy the night and evening. And I went and checked them out at the check station.
Oh, nice. Yeah. We've had a few of those over the years where, you know, like a lot of it's, I mean, if someone shoots a turkey, like really early in the morning and like, I wasn't planning on being home till 2 or 3. You mind if I hang out? I'm like, you know, we're going home. So
yeah,
don't stay here. We go somewhere else. But yeah,
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But yeah, no, hunters are funny. But, and I know Gray Lodge, people start lining up. Is there any type of, you know, lineup for Lotto or anything a Little Dry? How would that work for opening weekend?
It's going to be the same as always, as every weekend, where they show up at 6 o'clock, sign in, register for the lottery, and 8 o'clock, they'll do the draw. One of the nice things this year is there's going to be two different ways they can check where their lottery number stands. It'll either ping them on their app for the CDFW app, or there's also going to be a QR code that is posted that'll take them to a website that'll show them where they ended up in the lottery for each different wildlife area and refuge.
Oh, nice. Like all the technology, that's great.
You don't have to sit there till 8:30 now and see where you came out in the lottery. It'll ping you on your CDFW app. And for people out there that haven't seen that yet, they can go into either Google Play or the Apple Store and download the CDFW app. It's so much easier. You can purchase whatever you need to purchase. You can, it'll track your CDFW account and you can do everything from it. And it's extremely handy. And you can also use it as your hunting license. It's a valid form of license for you to either get on a refuge or when you're checked by a warden, you can show them that and they'll use that as, as your license, but it has to be the active app. It can't be a screenshot. If it's a screenshot, then it's not valid and we can't use it.
Yeah, and that's a reminder for folks. I mean, it's electronics, right? So if you don't have Wi-Fi or your phone's dead or whatever, so always have your license nearby in case it doesn't work. But yeah, I was stopped by a game warden on the river here recently, and they were in a boat, and he's like, let me see your license. I just pulled up my phone. He had some binoculars, and was like, yeah, you're good. See you later. <It's> like, <"Right." laughs> So that was the first one for me, but.
Before we go, got a couple of things about what we did out there. So at Howard Slough this year, we replaced blind 3. It's been leaking for the last couple of years. So we built up the island. The island had pretty much melted away. At Little Dry Creek, we replaced blinds 2, 3, 4, 10, and the stand-up blind 12B. And so all those are brand new blinds. Some of them are with the walk-in steps that come down to it, so make it easier access. And we're trying something new this year on those blinds where we built some blind covers, and we're going to see how those work and how well they hold up after a year of being abused. And we have two different styles that we're trying to figure out which style works best. We got the typical frame style that you see along on a lot of the rice blinds. And then we've got another one where it's kind of a Trex board that has vegetation in it, so you can move the vegetation and see through it, shoot through it. The big framed ones will actually push out and fold out in front of you. Then you can pop them back up. So we're going to see how it works. If they work and they're not in people's way and everybody likes them, then we'll probably see about putting additional ones on next season.
Now, is there ever plans to do more of those out at Little Dry Creek opposed to a lot of the pit blinds that are out there?
You mean the standing blinds or
not? Yeah, and having standing blinds opposed to the pit blinds?
No, I think we're mostly going to be doing pit blinds.
Okay.
We're talking about getting a couple more of the X-Fowler style blinds where people can push them around. We got two now, one at Dry Creek and one at Howard. And actually the staff was brushing those up today or the last couple of days. And man, they did a really good job because Derek showed me a picture of it. And my reply was, okay, what am I looking at? And he said, oh, well, yeah, that's what it's supposed to be. Then it took me a minute. Oh, that's the blind. Nice. So the blinds look really good so far this year. The islands that we rebuilt this year, they're pretty bare. Nothing has grown on them yet. So it's going to be bare ground in the blind covers, but at least there's blind covers. And it's just not the blind sitting out there. So
okay,
we'll see how they work.
Nice. Well, that's great. Yeah, those X-Fowlers are... Gosh, they're really cool. Used in the right scenario, and even if they're not in an area where you have a lot of tule growth, you know, and it just looks like a tule patch, and the bears just don't seem to mind it. I think it's just because it's water level and it's the tules are the right height. Where sometimes you get a stand up blind and it sticks, you know, up or it's really tall over everything that's around you, right? So, but those X-Fowlers are pretty neat.
Yep. Yeah, hope we can get a couple more in the next couple of years.
Awesome. Well, Dave, I just want to say thanks so much for coming on, giving us an update, and appreciate everything that you guys are doing up there, and thank your staff as well for doing a great job. So definitely appreciate you.
Yep, I will do. And thanks for having me, and always glad to brag about the wildlife areas.
So, Scott, you're starting to see some birds show up, a little less than normal, it sounds like.
Yeah, and you know, the last few years of these cyclical droughts made an impact. Thankfully, we do have some bodies of water that do hold incoming birds early down at Worcester. The Salton Sea, of course, holds birds. It's not the best water in the world, but it is loafing water. And then at San Jacinto, Mystic Lake is still about 60% full. Which is right next to the wetland unit. So that housed a bunch of birds and also did a tremendous job in providing brood habitat this past year for a ton of wetland species. So that was really, really exciting.
Oh, that's awesome. So we have senior supervisor with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Scott Sewell, who manages San Jacinto, Worcester. What else you got in control of down there, Scott?
As little as possible. Those two wildlife areas keep me extraordinarily busy.
Did I hear a rumor that you're
other duties?
Did I hear a rumor that you're retiring soon?
That is correct. You heard it right. I'm going to go to after the season and into March.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. It'll be 29 years with this department.
Wow. And the majority of it in SoCal?
Yeah, all of it in SoCal.
No kidding.
I started off in Region 5 on the coast in the Santa Barbara to San Diego counties. And in 2005, moved out to the inland deserts at San Jacinto. And quickly acquired Worcester a couple years later, and that's all from been 20 plus years.
Wow. Well, congrats on a great career. So give us some updates on what's going on with Worcester and San Jac in terms of, you know, the hunt programs. What can hunters expect? Any changes from previous years that people need to know about?
A lot of good stuff are happening. We've had some, you know, really good support from some of the other units within the department. And, you know, like I said, you and I spoke before, you know, you got to start thinking outside that box, that proverbial. And so we did, and we ended up finding some funds available through different programs that provided seed. And we were allowed to get a bunch of seed, not just for native grasslands, but also for improvement to wetland species. So we were able to get a bunch of new seed, good germination rate. San Jacinto was primarily millet. Worcester's was primarily millet and wheat and some ryegrass in the green feed fields. A good mixture down there. San Jacinto has done a phenomenal job. The guys, I have to give my hats off. Phenomenal job by both San Jacinto and Worcester. The crews are phenomenal. At San Jacinto, we got some late rains, which really help the Timothy fields stay green. And then as it was time to irrigate, it happened, you know, quick and fast, like you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And we got a couple of irrigations in, and they just look robust going into the end of summer, where we started to plant our millet and then do our irrigations. And it's, I tell you, the crew this last couple of years have done a phenomenal job. I mean, just, it's almost like Boone and Crockett looking crop down there. Just phenomenal. The heads of some of these Timothy patches are just unbelievable. Worcester's done a phenomenal job down there. Right now, we have CWA down there doing a bunch of work. And this year, Chad and I put together, it's about a $2.5 million grant that was working on Worcester. And it was about just shy of 800 acres. I think somewhere around 792, 793, just shy of 800. And we were able to get all of 115 done, and that's a big unit, and that thing has been in need of help and support for a long time, and just looks fantastic. 114B had to be done, and that got done. Y14, another big wetland unit. All of 513 got done, as well as a bunch of the green feed fields, a bunch of the upland units, which are just south of the headquarters. We were able to get graveled roads and re-gravel parking lots and improve some of the access roads and even put some gravel up some of the walkway blinds. Just a great, great job this year.
That's great. I mean, we've been working with you for a while down there, but I mean, what else is left at this point? It seems like you guys have reworked the majority of that refuge.
You know, because of its size and its relationship to the Salton Sea, its relationship to the water it gets from the Colorado River and the New River, because of that, there's such an impoundment of seed sources that are exotic and noxious and non-native. And we do have a terrible problem with Phragmites, tamarisk. Mm. And when you don't have the staff that you had back in the 1955 and 1960s, it's a lot of work, and you know, to no fault of itself, but just the way the state runs, You know, you lose a bunch of employees over the years, and equipment gets broken down and not replenished in time because money goes somewhere else. And but we've been able to get a whole lot of things done the last couple of years. We were able to tap into the drought funding that was out there, the wildfire resiliency money that was out there. We did some mosquito abatement money. We got a lot of work done, and so we were able to replace a bunch of equipment. Since I started, we've not lost any positions. We've only increased our positions. So, you know, having people that are hooking bullets involved is really important for the longevity and the health of the wildlife areas. I'm getting a little off track. So we have done a lot of work down there. Back to your statement, what's left? A lot. Because okay. There's a lot of areas that need to be reworked now. And San Jacinto is looking at a monster rehabilitation restoration project next year that will pretty much touch all the wetland units. Its fingerprint will be all over it. And it's developing and growing the wetland unit. It's reconfiguring water conveyance. It's a humongous project. It's huge. And it's going to go over about 3 years. It's about $5.5 million. This is all, you know, thankful to the Wildlife Conservation Board. I got to, you know, give my hats off to CWA and Mr. Chad Santier and myself and a few others that were really intricately involved in this. And we're just really excited to see it happen.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, in terms of water availability and those things, opening day is coming up on the October 18th. What is it going to look like on the landscape in terms of, you know, total huntable acres, things that are open? What should hunters expect? And with that, do you guys have any hunt program changes in terms of new rules or anything at the refuges?
Good questions. That's the question that is most frequently asked right now. So we're looking at both units being almost completely flooded. San Jacinto, we're confident will be fully flooded. Worcester, we're confident will be just about there. The water availability has been there for San Jacinto. Worcester has some other hurdles to deal with the irrigation district, but we should be right about there. One thing that needs to be recognized is the state wildlife system is going to the YLAP program, which is part of the reservation and check-in system. And all of us type A wildlife areas have to abide by it and go by it, meaning we will be checking people in, and at the same time, we'll be checking in the sweatline people in a different window, and it goes through a different database than we've been using before. So there'll be a little bit of a struggle. We were told to do more of a soft rollout versus a really hard rollout, so we were asking for people's patience. Thankfully, we have, you know, the staff to up another counter and up another window. Which will take a little bit out of our staffing for other stuff, but this will make sure that we have proper attendance in the check stations to fulfill the requirements to make sure we get everybody out in a timely basis.
Yeah, so how does that work with the extra window and checking those sweat liners in at the same time? Is it, you know, typing all their information in a computer? What's the big change?
Yeah, so the normal check-in process through the two windows that they've always used to go through at San Jacinto and in Worcester will be there. There'll be a third window. Well, some people will head straight to it because they don't have a reservation. And mm-hmm. They'll start processing then versus us waiting to the very end of it, having people submit. We throw it into a computer. It's got to go through the system, and it checks everybody's license and makes sure they're eligible to hunt.
Okay.
Not just be eligible to hunt, but eligible to hunt on our wildlife areas. This new system, and I'm not trying to scare anybody, but the new system is going to kick people out of eligibility if there are certain things that they need to attend to, such as maybe it could be anything from tickets to whatever. The system's going to recognize that, and we have no control over it. All we can do is do what we're given and told to do.
Oh, wow. That's it. That's interesting. So potentially, you know, someone that might have been kicked off a wildlife refuge and might show up, or, you know, someone that's not able to legally possess a firearm probably might ding up too. But that's going to be interesting. So if something like that happened, I'm assuming there's a number for the folks to call to try to get things squared away, because some people have, might have no idea that.
Yeah, we don't want to know, nor should we know what the issue is. You know, if it could be back child support, or it could be who knows what. I mean, and it's none of our business. So so for our own sake, we don't know that. All it says is that you've been identified and you need to reach out to Sacramento to, you know, follow up on it.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. Anything else in terms of like how the sweat line works or hunter quotas or anything?
Our hunter quotas are staying the same. Our blind numbers are staying the same, if not going up. Well, San Jacinto will probably lose maybe one or two at Mystic Lake. Probably not. We're looking to be the same as last year. Worcester is the same. Same for the mobility impaired. Same for the regular reservations. Both areas look phenomenal. You know, you can do all the wetland management you want and make sure you have the house nice and tidy and all the food out for the big party. But you, if the guests don't arrive, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I've been there a few times where everything looks amazing and you're like, where are the ducks? You know, and then sometimes, you know, the habitat might not be up to your liking and there's a bunch of birds. So I don't know. It can be frustrating at times. You do so much work and you're anticipating them. I mean, up here in the Butte Sink area that I work in, there's a good number of birds. Sanborn Slough has been pretty loaded. But, you know, going back to, you know, having all the water is absolutely amazing. Klamath has a lot of water and a lot of ducks. So I was talking to someone the other day where normally we would start seeing specks in pretty decent numbers, like around the end of August, early September. And at least for us, they didn't get into any significant numbers on our property until it was August 27th, I think. So, you know, a couple weeks later than normal, but I think it's just because there is so much, you know, habitat out there, which is a great thing. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And then, you know, we're all excited about this three sprig this year, so we'll see how that works out.
Yeah, that seems to be the only real change in the bag limits as well for us. We did see specks show up like they normally do at San Jacinto. They're already here. And we are seeing concentrations of teal, gadwall, and mallards in larger numbers down at Worcester. San Jacinto is still seeing them come in. Just the other day, we saw a large flock of them, several flights come in to San Jacinto as well. So they're starting to show up. We're excited about it. October turns things around for us. You know, the weather's changing for us already. We're out of the 100s, and Worcester's out of the 115s.
Yeah.
We're down to cool nights, cool mornings, warm days. It's starting to cool off for us. So fall's coming, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, same here. We're experiencing a little bit of some off and on rainstorms up here, which is definitely nice to get out of the 100 degrees. But yeah, we're definitely excited as well. We're going to be completely flooded up with our properties now here this week. So it is going to be very interesting to see what the birds do. But the one thing I did want to end on is, you know, where can hunters be informed and how can they get more involved with the refuge?
Great question, Jeff. Thank you. So we do have a mass email list that we have created, and it holds about 1,000 plus people in there. So I distribute them. I have them in different groups, and we put up notifications and news and updates for the wildlife areas. And we always talk about volunteer days and other projects we're doing throughout the year. We also have a pretty good connection and relationship with people on the social media side to get that out there as well on some of their platforms. And then, of course, our department website, which doesn't stay as current with us, but definitely does have the connection for the reservation draws and the success or non-success and our bird kills and what we take in. And it does have that information available.
Okay. Is there a particular time of year? I know, you know, you guys have a pretty good bird harvest each year. Is there a specific time of the year that's better to, you know, potentially apply or go down there?
Well, the application process and get drawn at San Jacinto is difficult. The ratio,
I've heard. Yeah.
The numbers are hard. I have a lot of people that including myself, have put in, and wow, it's hard. And then some people have drawn all the time. It's just how does that?
That's
happen?
Just how the it's just how it works, man. Yep.
You know, for the most part, we start off. You know, the first week or so starts off with a bang, and then we go into which everybody else goes through, especially in the Central Valley. We call it Slowvember. That just gets a little hard in November, but usually by December we start getting the really large flights of greenwing teal, the widgeon. They all pull in usually around Decemberish, and by January we're usually full. But our slower months are certainly the warmer months, and you know it's not uncommon for us to have t-shirt weather for Thanksgiving dinner. You know, it's.
Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah, it gets slow up here in November too, but there can be some really great days. But yeah,
before I said that, you know, last year in November, I think it was the second weekend, we had a smashing weekend. It was just like out of nowhere, just wow.
Yeah, yeah, no, those are. I think those are the best types of hunts, right? You have I try to have no expectations, anyways. But you know, you have zero expectations to even have a decent hunt, and then you go out and have just a phenomenal shoot. To me, those surprises are probably the coolest things about waterfowl hunting, when you just have no expectations and it just ends up being just a beautiful day and lots of ducks, and they all work, and it just all works out, you know.
You know, and when ducks are allowed to work, it's such a beautiful thing, because when the hunters are letting them work, and especially when the tighter knit wetland units that, you know, house more hunters, when they're all being a little bit more patient and letting those birds come into effective shot zones, it's just it's a beautiful thing.
No, it definitely is. Scott, is there anything that you want to leave us with today?
You know, thank you, Jeff, and the good times we've had, and hopefully we can do one more before I retire in March. And you know, I want to say a big thank you to a couple people. One, hey, thank you to the public. You know, you guys are the ones that come out and hunt our refuges. You do our cleanup days. You guys buy the stamps. You buy the licenses. We're here for you. And, you know, we're a public hunting operation in my department. And we grow ducks. And we like to make sure it's a good, safe, and healthy environment. And number two, man, I got to tell you, a big thank you to the crews. Our guys at San Jacinto and gals at San Jacinto Wister are just phenomenal. These are dedicated, hardworking individuals who rough out the hard times and stick it out and continue to come back and do it again like I have for 29 plus years, you know. And it's the value and the love of the job. You can teach anybody to drive a tractor or plant seed or whatever, or run water, but having something that you can't teach, like the desire, the passion, the love for hunting. It's either you think, hunting's all right, or you're anti, or you love it, you know. And most of us love it. And when you have the passion for your work, you know, it really shows, because you go with the good and bad, you take the punches, and you continue on your journey because it's the right job for you. And you know, we have most dedicated, educated, wonderful people working for us, and I just thank them tremendously.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you down there, and congrats on a great career and all that you've accomplished down there. And yeah, we'll definitely get back throughout the season, give a little hunter update down there. But yeah, just appreciate you and thank you everything that you're doing down there. All right, our next guest is Garrett Spann. He is the YOLO Wildlife Area Manager. He's been on the podcast before, giving us updates on YOLO. He was a schoolmate of mine out at Chico State, worked at Sac Refuge, and made his way down to YOLO. So, Garrett, thanks for coming on today. Looking forward to hearing from you and kind of the status of YOLO.
Yeah, appreciate it. Glad to be here.
So anything like big in notes of, you know, changes to the hunt program this year? You know, what should hunters expect?
You know, for this season, you're going to see pretty much everything is going to be the same as last year. No major changes. I mean, of course, there's some nuances in the habitat management. Some things change there, which I can talk about a little bit. But from like processing, you know, reservations, lottery, For the most part, all that will be the same. We're going through the same lottery procedures. There's going to be a little bit, you know, some different things in how we post lottery results, with everything kind of transitioning to this online component. So Yolo's been doing that, but it's going to be a little bit different, the format of the results that are posted online for lottery. But from an operation standpoint, in the morning, we're going to continue to use the scanners and process hunters that way. We're also going to be doing the lottery using the scanners, which will be similar to when you're getting processed in the morning. The one change that we are implementing this year is a lottery purge at shoot time. So in the past, we did a lottery purge, but it was always 5 minutes or so after the wildlife area filled. And so we really had no way to know when we were actually doing the purge. And so that was something we brought up at our hunt working group meeting this spring. And we just wanted to kind of set a time, you know, so it's more consistent. So hunters know when it's busy and the wildlife area is going to fill, what time do they need to be there to be able to participate in the purge? And so based on that meeting and from information from the hunting public, we decided on shoot time. Shoot time will change, of course, but shoot time is always going to be shoot time. So for Yolo, for hunters to know if when we get busy and the wildlife area fails on a regular basis, if you're going to participate in the purge because you got a bad number in the lottery, it's going to be at shoot time.
Yeah, because normally, what time were you guys doing that?
It really depended on when we filled. So okay. We couldn't actually give an exact time. And so when we get phone calls, you know, and our lotteries are getting up in that 180 range, 200 people in the lottery, if you draw a bad number, you know, especially after pheasant season, pretty tough to get on if you're not in the top 100, right? So couldn't really give that answer to the public. It was like, whenever we fill, you know, 5 minutes after we fill, which I can't put a time on.
Right.
So this at least gives us that ability to say the purge will be at shoot time. So show up 5 minutes before shoot time to make sure you're there for the purge.
And Yolo historically has some of the higher numbers of people in the sweat line. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And with that change we did last year, where it's like your name could only be in the lottery one time. You know, on average the year prior, like you were seeing lotteries up in the 350 range. Just by doing that change, you know, I think the busiest night we had last year was right up in around 200, like just over 200. So by doing that change, our numbers have definitely fallen, because you had a lot of people that were in the lottery twice. So you could double pretty much however many applicants you had, they were probably in there twice. And so by doing that, we've reduced the total applications, which gives us a better idea to understand what the lottery actually looks like. So it is busy. I mean, we're just close. I mean, I think Sac County probably has the highest per capita waterfowl hunters in the state, and we're right next to the Capitol. So it's a busy place. We're unlike what I saw at the Sac Complex. You know, you kind of went when the hunting was good, it was busy, right? Yolo is busy every day, all season.
Well, and it's a high producing refuge too, you know, habitat wise and waterfowl harvest. Yep. You mentioned the pheasant hunting. Now, last year was pheasant harvest was up. Do you expect that to continue throughout this year? I mean, what's the habitat look like on that side?
Habitat looks good. I think pheasant production looks good. I don't know if we'll see, like last year was a record. I think it was the total wild bird harvest at Yolo was like 687 total birds, which, you know, the year prior it was 300. So you more than doubled your harvest. Right. And then, you know, you'd have to go back to, I think it was like 2003, 2004 when they opened the Thule Ranch. So the first year that was opened to hunting, the pheasant harvest was like 600. And then it fell off considerably after that 1 year. And so last year was something we haven't seen, you know, and I have some staff that have been on the wildlife area for a long time, and it was, and we saw that in the production, right? We were seeing, you'd go out and see 150 pheasants in the morning just on the roads. So this year I we're seeing a lot of birds. I still think it'll be good. I don't think it'll be to that 687 birds, but I still think we're going to be over 300. You know, it's hard to say, you know, there's a lot of habitat out there for the pheasants to hide in. So I think the pheasant hunting is still going to be really good at Yolo, but flooding does have an impact on that. I mean, it does knock down the predators a little bit, but it also will kill pheasants or put pheasants on those islands, and predation can be really high. But we saw record number crow counts in the spring. So we were seeing a lot of roosters. We saw another good grasshopper production this year. We had a lot of irrigation, a lot of summer water. So the habitat conditions were there for pheasants to be successful. So I do still think we'll see good pheasant harvest.
Now, and I haven't upland hunted the refuge, but what does that look like on a pheasant hunting site? Is it, you know, specific fields? Do you do it in the waterfowl hunt areas? How is that separate?
So what we do is, so we have, when we're fully flooded, we have a max free roam quota of 75 hunters. So if you get a free roam tag at the check station, you can hunt waterfowl, you can hunt dove, you can hunt pheasant. There's no particular area that you have to go to. It's a huge area. What we also implemented a couple years ago was an upland only permit. Because we have thousands of acres of uplands and irrigated pasture that really isn't associated with wetlands. I mean, there's no, you know, you might get some goose hunting opportunity late season, you know, when the snows really get in and they're hitting the green grass. But for the most part, they're areas that are open more for dove and pheasant. And so we have an additional 20 hunters that we put in just for upland only. So if you want to hunt pheasants, there's potentially 95 spots to hunt pheasants on Yolo. Wow. So if you get an up and only permit, it's just pheasant or dove. So you cannot hunt waterfowl. So if you jump a pair of mallards in a ditch when you're hunting pheasants, you cannot shoot them because you're not permitted to hunt waterfowl. So it's just upland for those 20 permits.
Now, in terms of the habitat this year, I mean, it sounds like everything is on the up and up. What about, like, you know, you guys are pretty unique in terms of some of the other refuges where you guys have wild rice. How has this year affected that, and what does it look like for potentially opening day?
So this year they actually didn't plant any wild rice.
No kidding.
Yeah, so we have a new lessee that's farming the wildlife area, and they went with conventional rice. Because of the flooding, they weren't able to plant the entire, so there's about 1900 acres of rice, farmable rice, on the wildlife area. They probably planted about 800 acres. So a lot of it was fallowed this year, which we implemented a strategy this year where we irrigated over 1,000 acres of the fallow rice. So instead of letting it sit and be idle and just dirt, we worked with the lessee, and we irrigated it all summer. So we ended up just over 1,000 acres of irrigated rice, and it's a mixture of watergrass and sprangle top, amania, different sedges. But ultimately, it's a bunch of rice fields that have natural vegetation in them. And so there's very few fields that are just dirt, which is great. You know, that's a core sanctuary area and part of our hunting area. So having dirt fields is not something we want on the wildlife area. So it was kind of like, we did a little bit last year, but to try to pull off that many acres with a shared water system, I was very impressed with the results that we got, and we had a great working relationship with the lessee and letting us kind of irrigate all those fields and growing a bunch of weeds pretty much. But it looked really good. And there's some fields that are, you know, solid water grass. Some fields, you know, a little bit of both, water grass and sprinkle top and amania. It just depended on when we got the water on. So the later irrigations came up more with amania and sprinkle top, where the earlier ones that we irrigated late June, early July are solid water grass. So there's going to be in the block of the hunting area that wasn't farmed. We did irrigate all of that. And so there's plenty of cover out there on the checks, and the fields all have food in them.
That's awesome. Now, in terms of like opening day, what's your percentage of, you know, the percentage of the refuge that's going to be open, hunt area? Are you 100% flooded? What does that outlook look like?
So we won't be 100%, but we're doing much better. I'd say we're ahead right now in our flood up, which is good. So my goal was to have 15 of the 16 blinds open and have a free roam quota of 55 to 60. Right now, based on where we're at with our flood up, I'd say we're probably going to have all the blinds open and most likely be up around 65 to 70 in free roam. So we were able to, pumps are running good. I think with the flooding, our water table was high, a fairly cool, not as hot of a summer. And then mm-hmm. we did irrigate a lot. So water's moving a lot faster across the landscape. So units that may take 3 weeks to flood up are taking 2 weeks. So it is helping us out. And so we are seeing, you know, our flood up is proceeding ahead of schedule right now, which is good to see. And so as long as all of our infrastructure continues to run and doesn't, we don't have any major breakdowns, I think we'll be ahead of the game for opener. So we won't be full, we won't be at 100%, but we're gonna have a good amount of habitat flooded, which is good. The one area, because of flooding and late rice planting, they won't probably be harvesting rice until mid-October. So there's about 60 acres of planted rice that's in the hunting area that won't be open. So we call that like the west rice. That will be closed, but all the east rice, the middle and east rice, will all be open.
Oh, nice. And what's the bird use on the refuge right now?
It's fantastic. We're seeing, you know, I haven't done a count. We'll do one in mid-October, but based on what I saw out and about earlier this week, I mean, we're probably, you know, 40 plus thousand ducks, and there was over 1,000 specks. And so that's not even looking at the whole property. That's just kind of going through the core. So bird numbers are really good. Pintail are probably the number one bird right now, but there's a lot of mallards, a lot of teal, starting to see some widgeon, and then gadwall and shoveler. So bird use looks really good, primarily in some of these really big open water timothy units. But bird use is fantastic right now.
What's typically your guys's, you know, 1, 2, 3 bird harvest?
So this year it'll be different with pintail, right? So with pintail going up to 3 birds, I'd say pintail is going to be much higher. But green-winged teal and shoveler are typically, you know, 1 and 2. Last year the widgeon harvest was really good. So I would imagine you're going to see green-winged teal, pintail, shoveler, and widgeon are probably our top 4 is what you're going to see. But we also had, you know, last year the mallard harvest was the second best it's ever been on the wildlife area. So you're starting to see that, and I think that really goes more into the local conditions for hatchier birds. And so with really good local production of mallards, we're seeing that in the harvest, because most of that mallard harvest is taking place in the first half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of our local birds that are probably hatched, you know, on the wildlife area or close by that are kind of living here. And then late season, of course, there's tons of teal and widgeon around, so they pick up a lot more of that slack. But all in all, I think all species, it looks good. And we saw record numbers last year for goose harvest. I think this is the highest goose harvest we've ever seen on the wildlife area. So they started hitting the green grass very early last year, and people took advantage of that.
Must be the good manager out there.
Not me.
So like when people start targeting geese, those are in your free roam areas. Are they alfalfa fields? What fields are they targeting that are green, or is it just regular just uplands that are generating new grasses?
It's both. So we have a grazing lease on the wildlife area as well. So, you know, we have almost 1,700 acres of irrigated pasture. Not all of that's in the hunting area. A lot of that's not, but there's about 700 plus or minus acres of irrigated pasture that's in the hunting area. And so you get a lot of goose use in those fields. And then also with the cattle grazing in our uplands, you're going to get a lot of fresh green shoots of grass in our uplands. So they're doing both. And then awesome. We also have been planting winter wheat. And so we're going to do another 100 plus acres this year. We did 125 acres last year, which of course all got pretty much nuked from the flooding. So we're going to try it again this year. And those fields that we planted the winter wheat in got incredible goose use, of course.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any wheat left?
No. It was doing really good until we flooded. As soon as we flooded, you know, and we're a lot of those fields, we purposely planted stuff on high ground, but out of the 16,700 acres of the wildlife area, I bet you about 16,400 acres of it was underwater. So all those fields were inundated for over 30 days. And so it killed all the winter wheat. So we didn't have any of it come back. So we're going to try it again and see what the flooding does this year.
Yeah. It just seemed like last year was kind of, at least up here, like flood, go away. flood right after that. State flooded for a long time. Yeah, every year is different. We'll definitely see what this one beholds. But yeah, we're excited. Definitely the three pintail is huge. You know, mallard numbers are up too. Bunch of water up in Klamath in the northeast zone. So who knows what that's going to translate to during the waterfowl season, but just seems like everyone's pretty excited for everything to happen with the new rules and the populations being up. So,
yeah, I think there's definitely that, and as a hunter, right, there's that level of excitement. In my hunting career, when I started at 11 years old, you know, I've never seen a pintail limit over two. So mm-hmm. It's pretty exciting to see that and see how that, I think it's got a lot of folks excited about this year. And I think, you know, we see a year like last year with weather, cold days, a lot of clear, sunny north wind days. The wildlife areas and refuges should do really well. You know, in Yolo, right. We don't have the pulse flooding like you see at like Sutter Refuge or at Little Dry Creek. You know, when we flood, we flood. And it's typically not, you know, we flood for a week and open back up. Once Fremont Weir goes and we take, you know, there's 100,000 CFS of water coming into the Yolo bypass. I mean, it takes a long time for that water to drain off. So like last year, we got really lucky and we got real close a couple of times and we had some situations where we were out there looking and it was like, man, we're 2 inches away from roads going underwater. And we mm-hmm. made the call with the trends, you know, kind of staying stable or going down, that we'd keep the area open to hunting because, you know, again, once we close and we see a flood, it's hard for us to get back open in a timely manner. So we want to try to stay open as long as possible. And as long as we can keep safe access for the hunting community to get to the check station and get out, we may have to reduce quotas and close certain areas, but we're going to do the best we can to keep this area open as long as we possibly can.
No, dude, we appreciate that as a hunter and just everything that you guys are doing and putting on the ground. Definitely looking forward to another good year, but just want to say thank you for doing everything that you're doing out there on habitat standpoint. And I thought you've always done a great job in really fighting for the public hunter and providing the best and the most opportunities for everyone. So I want to say thank you for doing all that. But yeah, I just want to say thanks for coming on and look forward to catching up with you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.